A voice cries out in the darkness. Help me, they implore you. Unable to decline, you take up this side quest to explore Scald against the Black Priory. Hi, welcome to Doors and Dungeons. This is a side quest. So, for all of you listeners out there that have been listening for a while, you've heard the first floor, which was the first season, and you've heard the second floor, which is the ongoing second season. But what is a side quest? Well, I'm here to explain that to you. This is basically a mini episode. It's like I said, a side quest. It's shorter. And the idea is that sometimes you want to talk about something, just a random game that I'm enjoying, or something going on in the news, or something being, you know, developed, or something like that, that's, you know, evolved about gaming. And I really want to just quickly say that out there and get it, you know, low editing time, just ready to go. And so that's what a side quest is going to be. So it's probably not going to be as polished as the other episodes. Not that my other episodes are fantastically polished, but that's beside the point. And so, here we are with the first side quest, and we're going to be talking about a game called Scald. But first, I want to cover two things. First of all, some people have been asking me in comments and other places on Discord and things like that about this MOOC that I mentioned. It's a fan book. That's what a MOOC is, if you don't know. About personal computers in Japan. And this book is called Hobby Parsecon Guidebook. Okay, and it is made by Oak Mook, like oak as in the oak tree, Oak Mook. And the name of the author is Maida. Maida, I can't read that kanji. And yes, Oak Mook, and it's Oak Mook number 552. So if you go online and look that up, that should give you enough information to find it. Hobby Persicon Guidebook, Oak Mook 552. And it's a great, great, great book about hobby computers from Japan, starting with the TK-80 in 1976, going all the way up until, I believe it ends sometime in the late PC-98 era somewhere. Oh, no, it actually goes to PC-AT in 1991. But yeah, so that's a really, really great book. Check that out if you're interested in that. I know a lot of people have been asking me for more information about that. Next, I have a book that was sent to me, and, you know, full disclosure and all that fun stuff. It was actually sent to me to review, and I agreed to do that because I'm actually really interested in the topic. It's called The Kanji Code by Natalie Hamilton. And The Kanji Code is basically a study book for kanji, but it's if you're learning Japanese. But it doesn't work the way a normal study book is, where they just throw kanji at you and say, you need to learn these because these are the most popular ones here. Just memorize them and write them a bunch of times. What this book does is instead, it gives you a system and it breaks it down into components and teaches you sort of the rules and how phonetics work and sort of the basic ideas that underlie kanji and shows you how things would be pronounced and how you can sort of get an idea of what a kanji is just by the parts that are in it. And what it does is it gives you a system. So if you're someone who likes like phonetics and etymology and like understanding like the root of a language instead of just memorizing that language, this is a great book because it really does a lot to give you a real understanding of how kanji works instead of just being told, hey, just memorize it. So if that's what you're looking for, let me tell you what, this is a great book. It's by Ocha Press, which I believe is her own imprint. You can find it on Amazon. I believe you can find it in the UK Amazon as well as the American Amazon. You might be able to find it in some other ones, Australia and other things. Once again, it's called The Kanji Code by Natalie Hamilton. Now, let's get into our topic of the day. We're going to talk about we'll be right back. Scald. What is Scald? And here to explain what is Scald, it's Al. The Al of Scald, as I'm like to say now.
Hi there, Michelle.
So you are in Norway, in Oslo, Norway, is that correct?
No, I'm not actually in Oslo. I'm in another part of Norway. But I think Kickstarter routes it all through Oslo anyway.
I see. That's why.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, dang, because that's the death place of one of my favorite playwrights, the famous Henrik Ibsen.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. He's pretty famous in Norway as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, no, I was just going to say, it's strange because, you know, you meet Americans a lot who's actually heard about Henrik Ibsen. I think, you know, when you live in Norway, it's kind of hard to miss how famous he is, even abroad.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool. Really cool.
Yeah, well, I studied theater in college, so I...
Oh, wow.
I'm fairly well up on my theater history.
Yeah.
And he was one of my favorites anyway. So, okay, you have a game that you're putting together. And it's called Scald Against the Black Priory.
Yeah.
And this, you've got a Kickstarter as well?
I do. Scald Against the Black Priory is currently on Kickstarter. It's doing really, really well. We funded in 24 hours.
Nice.
And it's super, super. It's overwhelming. Kind of moving, actually, how passionate people have been and how supportive and cool people are. And we're going to be on Kickstarter until July 2nd, so we still have about 10 days left.
Okay.
Yeah, it looks like we're going to hit 200%, and that's really, really awesome for this kind of project, I think. Yeah, it's amazing. Really cool. And like I said, people have been so supportive, and I think it's really kind of struck a nerve, the kind of game Scald is. And so Scald Against the Black Priory is like an 8-bit style computer RPG that looks a lot like Ultima 4, Ultima 5, Magic Candle series, the Gold Box series. There's a lot of inspiration from Wasteland 1. And I think these are, you know, they're games from the golden age of role-playing games. And I think that's really struck a chord with a lot of people, I think. So that's super cool.
Yeah, indeed. I noticed that right away. It does look very much like a Ultima kind of game. And I was struck by just how polished all the pictures look. I mean, it's a good-looking game. It doesn't look like a budget version of Ultima. It looks like an improvement on the concept, and I think that's a very good thing. I think there's a lot of people that are focusing on, let's reproduce this old style exactly, for better or worse.
Exactly.
And this looks better.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Michelle. That's really nice of you to say. I think part of the like the secret sauce is that I've always had some fairly tight creative constraints on the graphical side. For instance, the color palette and the resolution, those are absolutes. There is only 16 colors in the game. It's the Commodore 64 color palette, and that's non-negotiable nowhere in the game. And also the resolution is always the same throughout the game. We never change it, and there are no assets that are of a different resolution than the rest of the game. Because often when you see retro clones, they always overindulge, and they do the character portrait is high resolution, but then the rest of the game is low res, and that really, really looks off, in my opinion.
One of my friends I was talking to recently, his name is Tom, and he was saying how this is one of his big pet peeves in gaming is when people go retro just for the sake of retro without trying to actually do like that core idea of what retro is, like you're talking about, where they're like, oh, we're going to do pixels and it's going to be like these huge chunky pixels and it's going to be, you know, way outside of the realms of what the limitations of pixel graphics would have been at that time. And so you get like these huge widescreen experiences with like super rich backgrounds or character portraits. And then you have like some character who's pixel, but then they're way too detailed than they should be, or way less detailed than they should be. And it looks like kind of a mishmash.
To me,
it doesn't bother me as much, but at the same time, when you look at something like what you've got here with Scald, it looks exactly the way it should for what it's trying to do. It doesn't look like someone trying to emulate that system. It looks like that system.
Yeah, but that's also kind of what's fun about it, because I do have some artistic license. For instance, the Commodore 64 had some restrictions on colors per tile. You know, you can draw as many colors as you would like on each 8x8 tile. But I don't adhere to that. I use as many colors as I like per segment of the screen. But I do it consistently. And it's not like I try to do it the Commodore 64 way, but then sometimes I do it the other way. I go all out on that. So, you know, I have some very core pillars in the graphical design, and I'm very, very disciplined in that. And I think that shows throughout the game. And I think that was a very, that was kind of like when the entire project really came together, because, you know, I experimented with some different looks and different styles. And then when I suddenly realized that, you know, just like making this, this creative constraint for yourself and then just sticking to it, that was kind of like when it came together for me, at least, I think.
Yeah, I can see that, because when you look at some of the screenshots, like, for example, okay, I'm looking at a screenshot of the, it says Scald, well, it's okay. So this is maybe the second screenshot on the Kickstarter page, and it says Scald ships with an optional retro style CRT screen filter down there. You can tell that there's way more colors than you would expect to see on an actual Commodore 64 machine. It's very, very vibrant and colorful, even though it's still using a palette that's definitely very old school and a resolution that's very old school.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's like that's one of those situations where you're using the limitations but also breaking the limitations in a way that feels fair. It doesn't feel like, you know, like it would be if you had like the main little viewpoint being really, really low res, and then like the character portrait being, you know, HD. That would be
absolutely cheap. Or the GUI. That's what a lot of games do.
Yeah, exactly.
Resolution GUI, and then just like the viewport is low resolution, and that looks really wonky to me, I think.
This looks, honestly, this looks more to me like what a C64 user would have dreamed of being able to,
exactly,
to play at the time.
Exactly. This would have been the best looking game on the C64 back in the day.
Yeah.
No, and I think, you know, it's, but, you know, and there are some people who have been like, I wouldn't say critical, but it's like we've had a discussion on some of the forums that I frequent about whether or not doing retro style graphics today is a good thing, or is it kind of like you're, are you pandering to an audience by doing that? But there's also the thing that, you know, there is some logistics that goes into making the game and also making graphical assets. And and that was kind of like that was the primary reason why I started looking into limited color palettes and very low resolution, because I realized I could never make the game with higher resolution. I need to be able to draw the tiles myself, and then maybe have some artists do like the scene images, the prettier images, like, but I needed to be able to draw all the tiles myself, and I needed to be able to do so and also animate the tiles in, you know, very short iteration time, or else I wouldn't be able to make the game. So it's also a very practical reason to do the game like this. It's not just like, to try and maximize on the nostalgia theme, and also like the C64 color palette. It does lend itself well to kind of like this, kind of like bleak, a bit horror-like setting as well, I think, because the colors are a bit like, they're not super vibrant and...
Yeah, they're kind of dark and...
Yeah, they are. They're a bit dull and, you know, like, yeah, so...
But there's a lot of colors here. I mean, it's definitely, you're using the colors to its max, what is available.
Absolutely.
The argument about pandering to the nostalgia crowd, when you're developing the game, there's one person that you should pander to, and that's yourself. And if you love this style of game and you love this kind of visuals and that's what you want to make, you're not pandering to anybody. You're pandering to yourself, and that was what you should be doing realistically. So I think if, you know, if that's what you want to make, make it.
Yeah, this is definitely a game I would like to play myself. You know, this is and it's because, you know, I was really into tabletop RPGs for a long time, and that's pretty much the whole reason I got into game development and programming, to kind of like extend that experience beyond just the tabletop. And so Scald is just, Against the Black Priory it's just a continuation of the campaign I ran when I was in university for my friends. Huh. Yeah, so it's kind of like I'm really doing this because it's fun. I really enjoy working on the game and kind of like being in that creative space of game mastering, but doing it to hundreds or maybe thousands of people down the line instead of just doing it to like the crowd around the table. That's really what...
Exactly.
Yeah, it's really cool.
So, okay, I want to get into a little bit more in depth on the game and its system and that kind of thing. So first of all, I want to know, what is the Black Priory? Without spoilers, too many spoilers anyway.
Yeah, the Black Priory is on the island of Idra, far out into like the northern Arctic Ocean of the Skull universe. There is like this tiny little windswept island called Idra, and on it is this really old monastic structure called the Black Priory that's home to this order of this religious order that suddenly, for some reason or another, kind of goes amok and turns into a doomsday cult. They go from being like this very quiet, reserved monastic order that spends its time reading and collecting ancient books, and then suddenly they go insane. And this may or may not have something to do with a whaling vessel that kind of shipwrecks on the island close to the priory. You know, you never know. You never know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Let's find
out. Might have been something on board. Maybe not.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So now the next question that I have, I want to know. So the one thing that I'm not 100% sure of is how the actual battle system works, because I'm looking at some of the graphics on here, but because you're not, I'm not seeing like the actual cursor as much. So it is using the command, like the command GUI, to do attacks, and is there a strategy to it, or do you need to move your character around, or are you just in the grid, or how does that work exactly?
Yeah, the game is the battle system, the combat system is very similar to or like the bones of the combat system, the skeleton of the combat system is very similar to games like the Bard's Tale games and Wasteland 1, in that the combat is menu based. It's not like you have this tactical map where you move square by square, which means that, so when combat starts, the game rolls initiative, you get the initiative order, and then you progress through the initiative, and then for each of your characters, you perform some kind of action. And there is definitely some JRPG elements to it now, but originally that was never the intention. In fact, I explicitly wanted to make more of a Western RPG-inspired game because I felt that they were kind of like underrepresented these days. There's a lot of like SNES games, SNES clones in the role-playing scene, and I really wanted to make like a game that was actually inspired a lot by Wasteland 1, but in a fantasy setting for like the systems. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that when you kind of animate the combat, when you draw the characters on the screen and then just do the Wasteland or the Bard's Tale combat deal, it looks a lot like a JRPG. and I think that's it's kind of cool because it's kind of come full circle, and it turns out role playing games are just role playing games.
Well, yeah. So this is okay. From what you've explained, it this is a very graphical representation of a pen and paper RPG. In fact, probably one of the most accurate, I would say, graphical visions of a JRPG. You know, I'm used to like the JRPG menu kind of being command system being that sort of Dragon Quest thing. You know, it's like, you know, the first person viewpoint or something like that, yeah. Or like the Final Fantasy thing where it's, you know, it's a menu, but it's a very kind of involved menu with a lot of cursors and stuff. And this thing feels more like you're like a physical representation of saying, okay, you know, to the GM, you know, okay, I'm going to attack this rat over here.
Exactly. And the reason why it's like that is that when the entire project started like years ago, I just wanted to make a game book system, you know, where there, you shouldn't even need graphics at all. It was just going to be like this interactive fiction thing. And then, so for the combat system, I wanted a combat system that didn't rely on having like a tactical map. And that's why the combat system could probably run just as well without the like the graphical presentation. It wouldn't look as nice, but it could. And also the reason why And, you know, all of the commands, they run through, you can just use the keyboard. The way you have like the 9 buttons down in the corner, it maps to the WASD. So it's very fast to run, and any action should never take more than like 1 or 2 key presses to do. So it's not like these really deep menus with a lot of load time. When you have it in your fingers, it's really, really lightning fast to just blaze through it. And I'm a huge fan of, I wouldn't say that I want the combat to be puzzle-like, but I'm a really big fan of games that have like pre-decision randomness, that kind of like it deals you this situation. You draw a hand of cards, and that might be random, but then you have to like make the best of what you have, you know?
Right.
I really enjoy that kind of combat or tactical puzzle. So that's what I'm trying to go for in the game.
So this is cool because to me, in the world of Western RPGs today, and even in the past, it seems like there's 2 like major types in this sort of retro camp, which is either this roguelikes, everything is roguelikes.
Yeah.
And I don't care for roguelikes at all because they're a little too, there's too much focus on like war of attrition and resource management and not enough focus on the actual combat.
Yeah, exactly.
And then also there's the other version, which is sort of the old Ultima style, which is that very sort of strategic thing that takes a lot of time and it's a little bit clunky to me. Yeah. This feels like a mixture of both in a way. And I think that's actually kind of cool.
Yeah.
I think one of the other things I think is neat about this is that it looks like it would be very easy to port this interface to like a handheld device, like an iPhone or Android, like that.
That's 100% my reason for doing, for having such a strong emphasis on having everything controlled through like the 9 keys down in the corner, instead of it being more mouse driven. It's because it will make it a lot easier to just port to handheld devices. And I'm absolutely going to do that. The Kickstarter isn't for handheld devices. That's only for desktop devices. But as I sort of get it out there and it's on Steam and it starts like getting some traction, the next step in this project is porting to handheld. So it's definitely coming. Yeah.
Steam is your platform you're using?
I'm definitely doing Steam, but I also want to do this, what's it called? DRM free.
Oh, the good old games?
Yeah, exactly. I would love to do good old games, but they are like, they curate their content, and there is no guaranteeing you'll get on that. And if I don't get on that, I'll probably do itch.io so that the people who don't want to use Steam can still get a version from one of the DRM-free sites.
I see.
Yeah, yeah. Because there's a lot of people who really care about that. They really don't want to use Steam. They don't want to have like this game that you don't really own. You don't have like the physical copy on the physical in quotation mark copy on your computer. Yeah. So we're doing both.
Now there's an option on the Kickstarter. Let's pull it back to the Kickstarter here for a second. There's an option on the Kickstarter if you spend the money to get physical. Yeah. Version of this. Will you ever sell a physical version for people who weren't able to do the Kickstarter?
I cannot guarantee that I will. And this has a lot to do with that, like producing and shipping physical objects in Norway and then shipping them to the world is a lot of logistics, especially since a big part of my market is not in Norway. I mean, 97% isn't in Norway because there are so few people here. Yeah. It's mostly people in the US. And I don't really, you know, we might do a limited edition or something like that if people are really into it. But, I can't have a huge warehouse with copies that I can't move.
Right.
Yeah. So probably this is the only way to get the physical things. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there will be PDFs of the manual and stuff bundled with the game, but physical prints is now or never.
How printable do you think those will end up being?
How printable?
Yeah, will it be easy to print those PDFs and things?
Yes, I intend for them to be. The map will be the map will be high resolution, so you can do with it what you want, and the manuals will probably just we'll make a PDF of the book file and you'll print it as any other PDF, and the interior of the manual will be black and white as well, and it will all be in probably A5, so in a very printable format. Definitely.
I wanted to say too that with the Kickstarter, You've got a cool couple things here going on. One of the things that I thought was neat is that if you have the money to drop, you can actually get the potential to have your own sort of design or a little bit of your own sort of character or content put into the game, which I think is a really neat idea.
Yeah, that's cool. Absolutely. It's been more common in games lately for people to have for one of their backer tiers being that people can sort of contribute creatively to the game.
For a game on this scale, I think that's actually even more interesting because it really does take your time and dedication to do it.
Absolutely. And I think it's one thing is like getting your thing in the game, but I also think it has something to do with interacting with the creator and sort of being part of the creative process. I think that's what might appeal to some people. So we'll see how many we get. Hopefully we won't. Right now it's looking that it's not going to be a big problem because it will also take some time for me, obviously, sort of adapting that to the game. But it's a cool little option to have there. And like I said, people have been super passionate. We have a little growing community, and it's really interesting to have these discussions with people. People are really, really into these kinds of games, and like the design space itself is so interesting because there are so many tropes, not only like from the story or game rules system, but also like the technical limitations or the tropes in how you would make the physical products and the manuals. And it's really, really fun, really, really fun project to work on. Really super fun.
So can you tell me a little bit real fast about the music as well? Because it sounds cool. The one video that I had, you know, that I saw on the Kickstarter, sounds really good. I like that.
So. Absolutely. The music is made by an artist called Cert R. You can find him on Twitter at Cert, S-U-R-T, _R. He is a really cool guy. He's made a couple of games himself. For instance, Der Geistschiff, which is like this dungeon crawler, sci-fi dungeon crawler with vector graphics. And he makes really awesome, very moody, like kind of like electronic music. We had like this really specific idea when we went into the game. I really didn't want the music to be like this standard Ren Faire fantasy music that's in so many RPGs. Right. Nothing wrong with that, but that's not the fit for Skald. Skald should be a little bit more. I really want to play around with some different trope spaces for the game, also with the music. So we wanted something that was a little bit more haunting, maybe, than like the standard Ren Faire music or even the standard music that you. I wouldn't say that the music in a JRPG is standard in any way, but there's also in JRPGs there's a type of music that's kind of like a little bit upbeat and we didn't want that for the game. Right. We wanted something that was a little bit more darker and a bit more modern. Yeah, something that we wanted the music to be something that definitely could have been in a Commodore 64 game, but due to like the design conventions, never would have appeared in a Commodore 64 game. This type of game, at least. That's kind of like that. Yeah.
So, okay, I have two more questions. First of all, roughly how long do you think this game's going to be? Your goal right now?
Yeah, so we just made, we're on our fourth stretch goal, which means that, and for two of the goals, we added more areas to the game, which means that the game will now be in three acts over three separate, but connected geographical regions. And I really want the game to be, I would really hope for the game to be around somewhere between 10 and 20 hours would be really, really cool. But I'm also 100% intending that you should be able to finish the game much quicker if you want to. And but you should want to spend more time in the game world. I really don't want padding or filler content or a lot of grinding. I would rather make a short game that's really, really good and polished than to sort of stuff everything into the game and just have these huge meaningless dungeons or this really grindy level progression. I don't want that at all. I really want the game to be on point.
Yeah, so I noticed that you did say that you wanted to stay away from grinding, which is really good because I don't have time for grinding. And Japanese people, like Japanese players, just really, really love grinding. I think in a way, it really fits in with the Japanese mindset. Having been here for 5 years, I can really just say that it's just a part of Japanese culture in a way. And I really don't have time for that. So it's really cool to see a game where I can enjoy the experience and rush through the parts that are not as interesting. Not that saying that the combat's not interesting, but you know what I mean? It's every now and then, just kind of like, okay, I have fought 20 rats. Do I need to fight 20 more, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's precisely it. Absolutely.
And then the other question that I had, though, is, so the resolution, you talked about the resolution a little bit. How is this going to work on a modern, say, for example, I've got a, 1080p LCD monitor here that's widescreen, all that kind of stuff. How does that work? Does the system, like, actually scale that? Does it have scaling options or things like that? How does it work?
Well, for now, the game maintains the resolution throughout. It doesn't change the resolution to match the screen resolution. That might be something we'll look into down the line, but that's definitely like a secondary feature for now. We'll have to see how the feedback is from people. And definitely whenever we're doing the port to handheld devices, we'll have to do something with the resolution. I think the resolution will be much like maintaining like the classical 16:9 resolution or 3:4 resolution is less important on the handheld device. People who play on handheld devices, they're not in it for the complete retro experience. And if we're doing it on handheld devices, we might have an option on desktops as well, but this is in the future. It's no problem to do it from a technical standpoint. We just need to do it and also stay true to the graphical design vision for the project, I suppose. Hmm. Yeah.
So what you're telling me then is for the desktop version anyway, I need to pull out my CRT monitor and plug it in to get the best experience.
Oh, that would be really cool. That would be really cool.
I have quite a few. If you listen to my podcast, you'll get a feeling. I have quite a few CRT monitors around my apartment, let me tell you.
That's awesome. Of course, the game will be able to run in full screen on any monitor. It does scale to fill the screen, but it doesn't scale to the resolution of the screen.
All right. Well, I think that's it for now. So Scald Against the Black Priory is a really cool looking game that you have an opportunity, if you run in there quickly, to get on board with. And I would really recommend it because this looks great. And last question is, when do you hope, of course, hope to have this game released?
Next summer, summer 2020 is the tentative release date for the game. That's what we say on the Kickstarter. And I think it's going to be, we're going to be able to do that, I think. We're optimistic.
Okay, so I will put the link to the Kickstarter in the description. So if you really, really want to check that out, which you really should, please do that. And, give it your attention and or money. Preferably money. And support. So thank you very much, Al, for coming in and talking to me. And I wish you very, very good luck on this very good looking game.
Thank you so much for having me, Michelle. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to this Doors and Dungeons side quest. Coming up is a full episode next week on the retro-inspired game Quest Lord and Quest Lord 2 for the iOS. So please check that out, and we'll see you next time.